I'm Taylor Holbrooks, host of Morning Edition. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make live streams like this one difficult to keep going. Stand up for public media and help fortify WYPR's future. Tell your member of Congress you support WYPR by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org, and thanks.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. In the summer of 2011, a story appeared in the Capital newspaper in Annapolis about a man who had pled guilty to criminally harassing a local woman. For years, that man fumed against the paper for publishing that story. He posted hundreds of vitriolic posts against the Capital on social media. He sued the paper for defamation. He lost. On June 28, 2018, 7 years after the story about the disgruntled man appeared in the Capitol, the man shot his way into the paper's newsroom and murdered five members of the Capitol staff: Rob Hiasen, Wendy Winters, John McNamara, Rebecca Smith, and Gerald Fishman. That was 7 years ago this week. My guest today is the former publisher and editor of the Capitol, Tom Marquardt. He's written a book about the murders, what the tragedy has meant for him, for the families of those who were killed, and for the Annapolis community. It is a heartbreaking chronicle of a horrible chapter in the history of our state and the profession of journalism, a profession which continues to be an object of scorn from the highest office in the land and which is distrusted by a majority of Americans. The book is called Pressed to Kill: Inside Newspaper's Worst Mass Murder. Tom Marquardt joins me on Zoom from his home in Naples, Florida. Tom, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Tom.
Well, thank you for your time. And I can't say I enjoyed your book. It's not the kind of book that gives one that kind of ebullience and pleasure, but it's a very well reported and thoroughly enumerates this very tragic event that happened in Annapolis and in our journalism community. Let's start with the name of the paper, because a lot of people get that wrong, and you mentioned this in the book. The Capital Gazette newspapers is actually more than just one publication. Explain how the company is set up.
In 2011, when this happened, it was called Capital Gazette Communications. And the Capital was the daily publication of the group. There was also a paper called the Maryland Gazette, which came out once or twice a week. And as time went on, the paper was sold. It was bought by the Sun Papers, and they dropped the Maryland Gazette. And so now it's called the Capital Gazette.
And your position, you were there for 35 years. What was your role?
I came as the managing editor in 1977, was eventually promoted to executive editor, and then finally as editor and publisher when I retired in 2012.
And let's talk a little bit about the five staff members of the Capitol who were killed on June 28th, 2018. Let's start with Rob Hiasen. Tell us a little bit about Rob.
Rob was considered the father of the newsroom. He certainly was older than most of the young reporters there, but more so, he was really the kind of guy who would be your father. He was encouraging. He counseled. He is quick-witted. He was a brother of Carl Hiasen, who was a renowned writer from Florida and a columnist. So he was revered. He worked personally at the Baltimore Sun, and then he was a feature writer there, and then came down to us in a management position, which he was looking forward to because he really wanted to take all the experiences that he had in writing and apply it to young writers. And it was great because everybody respected his writing, his counsel. He was just revered in the newsroom.
And how about Wendy Winters, another revered figure in the newsroom, very close to the community in Annapolis?
She really was, Tom, and more so than anybody. I had hired Wendy as a freelance reporter when I came there to write stories that were really community driven. It could be really small stories, a bake sale, it could be a car wash, it could be a club meeting, but it was really trying to get into the community as best we could. She turned out to be not just a community reporter, but a great reporter, a great feature writer who was willing to do anything. And so we just kept feeding her story ideas. And at one point, she was outwriting every full-time person on the staff. After I had left, they hired her as a full-time reporter as well as a community news editor. But as you say, she touched so many lives in the community because every story she wrote, there were parents, there were uncles, there were neighbors. They were all feature stories. There wasn't any crime reporting that would antagonize a reader. It was all positive things. And she just touched so many lives that when her funeral ceremony occurred, she probably had more people in attendance than anybody else.
And Gerald Fishman was the editor of the editorial page.
Yeah, he was an incredible editorial writer that I worked beside really on a daily basis because we would often talk about editorial ideas and he would write them. So Gerald and I were pretty close. He was an unusual guy. He was one of the brightest people I ever met. He could quote them Shakespeare. He could quote them the Bible, even though he was Jewish. I mean, he would write the editorials for Christmas Day. He was just the kind of guy that was very versatile in what he wrote about, very intelligent. His editorials were so cogent and so well-respected that few people found any holes to poke in them. I mean, I was convinced that Gerald Fishman could be an editorial writer for the New York Times, but he was happy being where he was, and he really made our paper well-respected in the community.
And John McNamara, a guy who lived and breathed sports.
Not only did he live and breathe sports, but he lived and breathed Maryland, University of Maryland sports. He was a Terp. He followed the teams very closely. He wrote books about those teams. He was always well respected in the box office. I mean, he was just in a press box. I mean, he was just well respected as a sports writer who knew more about the Terps than probably anybody.
And a young woman named Rebecca Smith wasn't a reporter at the paper. She was in the advertising department. Tell us a little bit about Rebecca.
Yeah, she's not one I knew. She'd only been at the paper for a couple months. She was the first person that you would see if you came in the door. Worked for both the editorial and advertising department as sort of an aide. But she would help anybody who came in the door. She was fighting a lot of personal health issues. But, you know, she was about to get married. She had a great family, a great support system, struggled in life, but finally found a job that she was really comfortable with and enjoyed.
And you make a decision in this book, Pressed to Kill, not to use the name of the shooter. There are various news outlets who have differing opinions about how these kinds of stories should be reported. I know there are at least some shows on CNN that refuse to name the people responsible for perpetrating mass shootings. And you've made the decision not to do that in this book. And you've invented a name. Tell us about the process you went through to come to that decision about how to handle that, you know, very, very sensitive issue.
It was my full intent to use the real name. I didn't really want to give the guy any attention, but the bottom line is that the book was factual from day one, and the people who read a draft of the book challenged me on not using the name because everything else is factual. But as I got into the story, and as you learn as you go into the book, using a person's real name just glorifies the perpetrator and can even lead to copycat killings. And so he did this, the murderer did this to really gain notoriety. And by using his name, I would be playing right into that. So, you know, I made the decision that that was not my goal. It was more important to chronicle and immortalize those people who died, as opposed to putting this guy on a pedestal. So the best way to avoid that was simply not to use his real name.
And there was a reporter at the paper in 2011, a guy named Eric Hartley, who wrote a story about the shooter's conviction in a case involving his harassing a young woman whose name you do use. Her name is Laurie Sondervan. Tell us what that trial was about. Tell us what the shooter was doing to harass Ms. Sondervan.
Before I begin the story, I'm able to use her name now because she has changed it, and she allowed me to use her name because she no longer uses that. So the original story stemmed from a court case in which Lori had filed a stalking complaint against what is a former high school classmate. This high school classmate had reached out to her through social media trying to reconnect. And this was like years after, I guess something like 13 years after they had graduated. She did not remember this student because he was pretty much a loner then. But she checked with other friends who had attended the same school, and they confirmed that he was a student then. So she was just a really nice person, and she says, yes, I remember you, and let's keep a conversation going. So really, they had communicated by messenger or other social media access, never talked on the phone, never met personally, just had communicated. It became pretty frequent, and at some point, Ms. Sondervan just thought it was getting a little too close. And he would get upset when she didn't respond very quickly. So she backed off and basically said, please don't contact me again. And he got very upset. So that's when he took action against her by calling her boss at the bank where she worked. She lost her job as a result of that. He called her parents. He posted things on internet, fouled her tractor. But when it got to court, all he could basically do is settle for not a stalking charge, but a sexual harassment. So he pled guilty to sexual harassment and was given probation. And she thought that was the end of it. We had a reporter in the courthouse, Eric Hartley, who thought this was a good story because it basically warned other people, particularly women, of the difficulties and the risk of being on social media. And so his story was really replete of any kind of bias or prejudice or even opinion. It was just a straight story that talked about what this guy had done to her and why she was very concerned enough to file these charges. So it was really, honestly, just a typical court story that would appear in our paper almost any day of the week.
Tom Marquardt is my guest. His new book is called Pressed to Kill, Inside Newspaper's Worst Mass Murder. We're talking about the murders that occurred in June of 2018. The anniversary is coming up this week on Sunday, I believe, June 28th, 2018, where five members of the Annapolis Capitol staff were murdered by the shooter that we're talking about now, and what led to this. So this story by Eric Hartley runs in July of 2011, and the shooter somewhat immediately reacted very badly to the story and began harassing the paper. Tell us about that.
He created a page that was basically aimed at the reporter and currently, and then eventually me as the editor. So he took issue with us and making a story without giving him a chance to talk, which we did, but his lawyer decided not to let him know we were trying to reach him. So he started making threats, but interestingly enough, when it started out, the threats were really vague and obviously very convoluted, confusing. We really weren't quite sure what they were saying. Eric followed them very closely and would point those out to me, and we just sort of dismissed them as being, you know, a reader who just wasn't happy with the story. In many cases, we didn't understand what he was saying, and what we didn't know then, what I know now, is that he was taking a lot of references out of video games that he was watching that we just didn't recognize because we didn't play these video games. But he had characters that he was attaching to us. I was Evil Tom. Well, in the video he watched, the game he played, it was Evil Otto. So he had applied that character to me. You know, he would at some point say, he's going to sue us. At one point he says, I'm going to go to journalism hell. Well, you know, it's not quite a threat on my life, but obviously he was threatening me. And so we became concerned as time went on, but we sort of just kept an eye on it without doing anything. And then he eventually filed a lawsuit against us.
And we're going to take a quick break and we will talk more about this new book with Tom Marquardt. It's called Press to Kill, Inside Newspaper's Worst Mass Murder. It's about the shootings at the Annapolis Capitol 7 years ago this week. The anniversary is actually on Saturday, June 28th. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on our show tomorrow, I'll speak with two freshman members of the Maryland Congressional Delegation, Representative Johnny Olszewski Jr. and Representative Sarah Elfrith, about President Trump's decision to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities without congressional authorization and what the road ahead includes. Plus, the artist Vincent Stringer will preview an art exhibition that he's put together called My Soul is a Witness, a Journey Through Art and Spirituality. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the journalist and author Tom Marquardt. We're talking about his recently published book about the murders at the Annapolis Capitol 7 years ago. It's called Pressed to Kill, Inside Newspaper's Worst Mass Murder. Tom Marquardt, a veteran journalist of 40 years, was the editor and publisher of the Capitol at the time that a article by a reporter named Eric Hartley ran in the Capitol caused the ire of the person that the article was about. This was a shooter whose name is not mentioned in the book. When we covered this event, when it happened 7 years ago, we didn't utter his name as well, and we're going to keep to that policy. But this man in his mid-30s was found guilty of harassing a woman who he had attended high school with some years earlier. That guilty plea was talked about in the article by Eric Hartley in the Capitol, and then that began a series of very threatening and vitriolic posts on social media. Tom Marquardt even posed directly to the paper, right? I mean, this was a person who was definitely on your radar. You retired from the Capitol in 2012, so this went on for about a year before you left the paper. It wasn't just on social media. Didn't he actually write letters or make comments directly to the paper?
He wrote one letter to the editor. It came at a time in which he had already filed a lawsuit against us. And it was bizarre because usually a lawyer will advise their clients not to engage in any kind of communication with the person that they are suing. And so I looked at the letter, talked to our attorney, and decided that it just may mess up the case by printing this letter. So I opted not to print the letter. It really didn't say a whole lot, and it was very threatening in itself. So I disregarded the letter, which is just part of the bizarre behavior that this guy was taking. He was, you know, all in all, he wrote over 800 tweets during the time that he was focused on me, the reporter, and the newspaper. So it was just another chapter. The lawsuit was really serious. He had filed that just himself. He wrote up all the paperwork, didn't hire an attorney. And like the tweets, it was as convoluted as anybody can imagine. So no surprise that he lost at every round. But that was really what was taking place my last year at the newspaper.
So the judge in the defamation case, a woman named Maureen Lamassny, dismissed the case with prejudice, which meant that this man could appeal, but he couldn't refile his lawsuit. What does that mean for those of us who aren't legal eagles?
Yeah, that basically means he just can't take another run at it by using some other fictitious claim. So that's with prejudice. So he could not reclaim it, refile it, but he was able to appeal it to a higher judge, which is what he did.
So, and that it was eventually dismissed in a higher court as well. As you think back and as you researched the book and reported the book, were there things that the police could have done, that law enforcement could have, acted on? Were there things that he said, things that the threats that were made to you as an individual, to the paper as a whole, that could have been acted on? You talked about how, I guess, it was the state's attorney's office had collected all these threatening tweets, and they showed them to the police. You mentioned that there were more than 800 of them. As people, look back on it to learn from it, what can we learn? What could have been done, if anything?
Yeah, that's the tough part, Tom, because hindsight's 20/20. And you can easily read the tea leaves today that we weren't reading back then. But the threats were becoming more hostile. I mean, in the lawsuit, this is in the lawsuit, not a tweet, he said he wished he could bash Eric Hartley's face into the cement until he was dead. Now, I don't know how much closer you can get to a threat than that. He wished I would go to journalism hell. He wished I would stop breathing. He wished I would follow the footsteps of my boss who had committed suicide. So these were not just idle threats. These were getting really close. And we had approached both the police and the state's attorney's office, asking them to review this and see if there was a criminal charge. The state's attorney's office turned it over to the police because basically they have to take action before the state's attorney office can do anything. So the police looked at it, and they looked at all the tweets. They checked to see if he owned any weapons. They checked to see if he had any criminal background. They did what they could on a computer, and that's really about it. And they came away saying they thought it was a disgruntled reader who was just simply acting out his complaints, but that he, quote, represented no physical threat to us. And by that, they meant he never came into the office waving a gun. He never confronted us, touched us in any way that would indicate an assault. So there really wasn't there anything there for them to file any kind of a charge. I was very unhappy with this. And I said to the people around me, including my attorney, what does this guy have to do? Come in here with a weapon? And I think we're all pretty upset, but our options were very limited at that point. One, we could have filed a restraining order against the guy, which the police advised us was an option. But we looked at it and thought that would only make matters worse, that he would gloat with that and maybe ramp up his attack. And we felt our best option was to stay silent and just not give him any more grounds to come after us. The police in that investigation had said that they will follow up by monitoring the social media accounts that he had and that they would visit him. They didn't either. So I, at that point, was away from the newspaper. I had retired, but I stayed in contact with my successors and the attorney because I was still in that lawsuit. So there was a need for me to stay in regular contact with them just to keep apprised of what was going on in court. But the point here is that the police are limited in what they can do. Am I unhappy? Yeah, I'm really unhappy. But I also will admit that they are handicapped by what they can do under these circumstances. Sometimes it's real clear that there was a threat, other times it's not. So, anybody who is in a similar situation should call the police. But the question is, do police have all the abilities and all the authority to really take action to prevent something like this happening?
And, you know, the First Amendment is a very powerful, strong dimension of the U.S. Constitution. And he has a right to say a lot of things, even if they are threatening and horrible and certainly distasteful, just as the Capitol has the right to publish editorials and reports that they think deserve, you know, public attention. This is happening in, this goes on for 7 years. I mean, the story by Eric Hartley runs in 2011, and he doesn't commit his murderous rampage until 2018. And at that point, Donald Trump is the president, and we'd become used to hearing about the press being the enemy of the people. What connection do you make between that kind of rhetoric that we heard from candidate and then President Trump in his first term, and many people who support the president talking in such disparaging terms about the media in general? Do you make a connection between that kind of rhetoric in the public square and what this particular individual was doing? Do you think his vitriol was exacerbated by the public discourse around the press and the media? How do you see it?
It's a difficult one, Tom, because there was really no connection made by investigators to what Trump said and what this guy did. We don't know what his party affiliation was. He hadn't spoken out against newspapers prior to this incident. So there really wasn't any trail that would attach those two dots. However, he made references in a lot of his tweets to other killers, other mass killers. He made references to Trump. He made references to a couple of other politicians. Maybe not a direct link, but there's no question that kind of language is setting up an environment in which it's okay to take physical action against people in the news media. And we're not the only ones. Politicians are now wrapped up into this as well. So, you know, the issue out there now is that if you're not satisfied with what you get out of a court, then there are alternatives, and this being the worst. So it's just an atmosphere that is so highly charged with especially the media that this is not going to be the only time, unfortunately, that physical action is taking place against some journalist out there. It's going to happen again.
And in fact, this particular incident was the worst mass shooting at a journalism enterprise in history, but you know, journalists are harassed by individuals and by states around the world on a daily basis. The book is Pressed to Kill: Inside Newspapers' Worst Mass Murder. The author is my guest, Tom Marquardt. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you'd like to contribute to our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. We have an email from Marilyn, who says, I was a reporter at the Capitol Gazette from 1972 to 1974. This was heartbreaking. Heartbreaking indeed. It was just such a shock and such a terrible occasion. I remember it quite well. In full disclosure, Rob Hiasen, one of the people killed that day, was a friend and acquaintance. My wife worked at the Baltimore Sun for more than 30 years, and Rob was her colleague there, so we know Rob and his wife, Maria, and have known them for quite a while. So, Tom Marker, you write a lot about the trial. One of the issues that comes up in this story is the insanity plea. Was this guy simply nuts. He's 38 years old. He was, as you mentioned, a loner in high school. He remained a loner as an adult. How did his defense handle the notion of his sanity and you know, ability to stand trial and understand the charges against him?
Well, it's like any criminal trial. You have experts that could testify in both directions, and in the end, it really was a battle of the expert witnesses. So, you know, in his defense, I mean, what they were trying to prove was that he was insane at the time that he committed this murder, which means he knew what he was doing was wrong when he pulled the trigger at that instant moment. So it's very difficult to prove. Maryland, like many other states, had changed the law to put the burden on the defendant to prove that he was insane. And so this was a very difficult thing for him to overcome, as it has been for Gacy and many other people who were found sane at the time of their murders as well. So what they had to do was to show that he had things happening in his life that put him on a level where his autistic disorder made him unconscious of what he was doing. Frankly, it didn't hold water for a second. I think jurors saw right through it. The judge saw right through it. The prosecutor knew exactly how to prove that he was sane when he did this.
The prosecutor was a woman named Ann Colt Leitis. She was familiar with this gentleman, wasn't she? She knew about him before this trial started.
Yeah, amazingly so. I mean, I think at one point, you know, she had actually knew about this guy because he had made a complaint on another charge that was a sort of attached to this. And so she was aware of the name and she had to take action. And so that was where she ran across him.
You did not ultimately interview the shooter who is in prison for life. How did you deal with that particular dilemma, whether to talk to him or not? You talked to a lot of people. You interviewed all sorts of folks for this book, but you decided not to speak with him. Why not?
Well, you know, the reporter in me really wanted to go up there and just talk to the guy. And that was my initial instinct. And then I started thinking, what would my questions be? I already knew why he did it. I knew how he did it. I knew where he did it. So there really wasn't much left for him to tell me. The risk, on the other hand, was for him to stare me down as he has everybody else and gloat. I think the fact that I was writing a book and there across from him would make him proud of what he did. I mean, he had to know this guy. I mean, I watched the films. I watched when he was caught hiding underneath a desk in that newsroom 8 minutes after the police entered the newsroom. And when he was pulled up from underneath that desk, he wasn't breaking a sweat. He had no emotion. He was just gloating. And that's exactly what he would have done had I stood opposite him. And I wasn't going to give him that privilege.
You also had access to a psychiatrist, a Dr. Patel, who spent many hours speaking with this shooter. And you had access to Dr. Patel's notes and you got a lot of information from Dr. Patel. How did that work?
Yeah, that was the most revealing part of the book, I think. When you read what the killer had talked to the state psychiatrist about, you really see a really evil man. And this is a guy, if you remember, refused to talk to police when he was apprehended. Dodged all their questions, was unidentified for hours, never talked until he got in jail, and then it was just really what he wanted to eat. So now he comes before a state psychiatrist, and he spills his guts. So all of it is out there to be had. I mean, so I learned about his childhood, what he saw as injustices by his parents, what happened when he tried dating, and how women reacted to him, how he reacted to his own family, how he disowned them, and then basically what his grievances were against the newspaper and how he was coping with it. And in the middle of all this, and this, I'm reading this for the first time, I'm reading that his biggest regret is not having killed me. And
right, Tom, he named you. He named you in particular.
Yes, and Eric Hartley too. But he named me in particular. So he knew my name. When the police got to his apartment after the killings, they found my address and my name and address on the computer right next to him. So, you know, he had intentions. You know, obviously he wanted me in the newsroom that day as well as Eric Hartley. So all these accounts to the psychiatrist are very chilling, very chilling. And this is a guy who's never committed any kind of crime before this, but, you know, he was determined and he was suffering from some mental issues like narcissism, but not, he wasn't mentally insane.
The book is Press to Kill, Inside Newspaper's Worst Mass Murder. The author is my guest, Tom Marquardt. We will continue our conversation with Tom after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest today is the author and journalist Tom Marquardt. His career in journalism included 35 years as an editor and later as an editor and publisher of the Capital Gazette newspapers in Annapolis. Marquardt had been retired from the Capital for 6 years when a gunman stormed the paper's newsroom and shot to death five staffers of the paper back in 2018. Rob Hyacin, who was an editor and columnist, Wendy Winters, who wrote features for the paper and also edited their special publications, Gerald Fishman, who was a columnist and an editorial page editor, John McNamara, a sports reporter, and Rebecca Smith, an advertising sales assistant. In conversations with the psychiatrist after the shootings, the gunman stated that one of the people he regretted not killing that day was Tom Marquardt, as we just talked about before the break. Marquardt has written a somber and well-reported book about the people who died and their families, the co-workers who survived the attack, and how the community has responded to this unimaginable tragedy. That tragedy took place 7 years ago this week on June 28th, back in 2018. The book is called Press to Kill, Inside Newspaper's Worst Mass Murder. To join us, we're at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So, Tom, there were people in the newsroom who were able to escape. One, Phil Davis, was a crime reporter who was wounded during the attack. Others were able to get out. Two of those people in the newsroom that day, Paul Gillespie and Janelle Cooley, are still there, but the others have left. Rachel Pacella and Celine Sanfelice are no longer with the paper, and I guess neither is Phil Davis. You write a lot about the community, Annapolis as a city and as a community, and how they've responded. As we get further and further away, we're now in year 7 since this event. Do you think that the memory is beginning to fade? Are there do you have concerns that this will not be held up in history and in the way it should be in that community?
Well, Tom, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I don't think it should fade. As someone said to me, you know, without the book, this would just be a fading headline. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, because people generally move on. And that was the greatest fear that we all had at the time, was that people would get all excited about what happened to Annapolis, and then they go back to their jobs and their lives until the next mass murder occurred. And indeed, there's been more than 200 mass murders since the tragedy in Annapolis. So life did move on. But I think, you know, if it was up to me, a book would be written about every mass murder because they need to be remembered. The lives of those who lost, who were lost, their lives need to be remembered. And a book has a better chance of doing that. It'll be at a library, you know, it'll live in infamy as long as it's an interesting read. But it's also journalism history, and it's Annapolis history. I mean, Annapolis, as you know, has a tremendous amount of history. If you look up Wikipedia right now, you're going to find everything about George Washington and Kunta Kinte, and there, somewhere in the body of history, is the worst mass murder in newspaper history. So it is something that has to be remembered because we don't want history to repeat itself. And I'm afraid that's going to happen based on, you know, what we know now. But that was really what we wanted to do, was to make sure that people remember this. And tragedy has no end to it. You know, it's just as tragic on Saturday as it has been the previous 6 years. It doesn't change anything, and we don't want it to just fade. We want to remember it, no matter how difficult it is for me and for everybody else who's involved in this story.
You tell us a lot about the people who were killed that day and their families and how they have, tried to cope with this, unimaginable event. But you also write that there were many people close to this event who didn't want to talk to you, who didn't want to participate in the writing of this kind of a book. Why not? How did you handle that? As a person who, obviously wants to be sensitive to how people feel.
Yeah, that was really difficult, Tom. I mean, there were a lot of people I didn't know, new reporters who had come after I arrived. There were spouses who I probably met but didn't know really well. And then there were other people like Paul Gillespie, Pat Ferguson, Janelle Cooley, who I worked alongside of, who I did know. And a couple things happened. One was that there was an attempt to video and chronicle this. Before my attempt to write a book that did not go down well. They didn't think a very good job was done. So, I mean, there was that they didn't want to repeat. Three people, at least three people, if not four, said it was still too raw. They didn't want to talk about it again, and they wanted to move on. So there were people who I reached, and simply that was their response. And I did have one spouse who did talk to me, who later changed her mind, and I had to pull out all the quotes I had from her. So I understand it. It is raw. They don't know me well enough. They thought I heard from somebody else that I was writing about this tragedy to profit from it. Yet I made sure that in the book it's told that all profits will go to the Fallen Journalist Memorial. So I'm not making any money off of this book. If there is any profit, it's certainly going to go to a good cause.
And that's a memorial that's in the town of Annapolis, right?
No, that's a memorial that they're going to build in Washington, D.C. There is a memorial in Annapolis, but the Fallen Journalist Memorial is going to recognize every journalist who died pursuing the First Amendment.
And it's also, I guess, interesting would be one way of characterizing it. But the Baltimore Sun, which is the company that owns the Capitol, and the Capitol itself doesn't want to do a story like the one I'm doing today here on Midday. They don't want to write about this book. So not only did you have people who didn't want to be involved in the book, you've got your former paper making a decision to not even cover it. What do you make of that?
It's disappointing, Tom. That's the best I can say. When I was editor, and I think any good journalist out there who was an editor, there have been many stories that I didn't want to see the light of day. They were promoting somebody I didn't want to promote in the paper. But every time I looked at it at its news value, if it was a story, I may have held my nose, and we did it because that's our objective. I think anybody out there worth their salt in journalism is going to judge every story based on the merit, whether or not it's news. And I think it's news that the book has been written about this tragedy. and that there are some revelations in there that people may not have heard before. So all the contacts I've made through newspaper personnel have gone without response. So Tom, I don't know what their reason is. You know, I just don't know. But that's sort of the wall of silence that I've found.
Well, when you contacted me about the book, I didn't hesitate to want to do it because I also think it's really important that people don't forget, and that if there are new insights, which there are in this book, you've pored over the court transcripts, you've given us information about those we lost, those who survived. There are things that most people, a lot of people, didn't know, won't know before reading the book. So I think it is important for people to be aware of that. But I think, you know, the fact that all this is happening and people's reluctance and even the paper's reluctance to cover it just shows what a raw and difficult wound this continues to be for people in that community. How about for you? You write in the book at the end that there were those who suggested that given your very conflicted emotions about what happened and your role in it, in that you were aware of this man's dissatisfaction in the last year you worked at the Capitol, there were those who suggested that it would be a cathartic experience to chronicle it and report it. But that didn't evidently appear to be the case. What happened?
Yeah, it wasn't cathartic. As much as I thought it could be, I didn't really go into this thinking that was going to be the real motive. I mean, the real motive was to get the story out. But as I got into it, I was learning things I wish I had not known, that this guy wanted me dead, how he killed each person individually. I looked at the film that was on the body cam of the police officers, the film that was in the office cameras. You know, it just dragged me down into that chasm of emotions. And, you know, like I said, I won't regret it because I'm glad the story is out. But it did impact me. Certainly not to the extent, and I want to emphasize this, it's certainly not the extent of the spouses who had to deal with this at the time, or the six journalists who had to escape that day. But there were a ton of people impacted beyond me. And this is the point that I've tried to raise with people, is that the true toll of a mass murder is not really known beyond that circle of immediate survivors, because they include first responders, some of whom had ADHD.
Sure.
There are the witnesses, the people who saw this unfold across the hallway, the guy who was on the phone listening to this happen.
Well, as you say, there are a lot of people affected by it, and I appreciate your time telling us about it. Tom Marquardt, the book is called Press to Kill: Inside Newspapers' Worst Mass Murders. And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, I'll speak with Sarah Elforth and Johnny Olszewski, two congresspeople from Maryland, about Americans' involvement in the war between Israel and Iran. Fresh Air is up next. Thanks for listening.